Hello everybody, welcome to the Boxing Science Podcast. This is episode 33, another Q&A session where I cover a range of different subjects around strength and conditioning and sports science in boxing. In this episode, we've got a wide range of subjects. We're covering lower back pain for boxing, strength training for teenagers and youth athletes, managing strength training around regular competition, something that's quite often in amateur boxing, the use of the sledgehammer for boxing to develop speed and power, managing weight category selection for youth athletes, again another important one for amateur boxing, and also amateur bouts, how many amateur bouts should you have before turning professional. So before we kick on with the podcast, quick favour, if you just hit the like or subscribe button to make sure you don't miss out on any of our future content, whether you're watching on YouTube, Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And let's get on with this week's questions. So this first question is around low back pain for boxing. And the subscriber has said that is experiencing low back pain towards the left side of the back and just above the glute. Now, this is quite common in boxing. And what it sounds like, this muscle is a strain, an ache or something like that, or some soreness of the QL muscle, the quadratus lumborum. So we'll call it QL for short. And the QL is responsible for controlling and acting on the side bending of the spine, so lateral flexion of the spine. And this becomes quite tight and overused within boxing for a number of reasons. The main reason is that boxers are quite tight in their shoulders and tight in thoracic rotation. Because they're quite tight in thoracic rotation, they look to compensate either through extension of the spine. This is why they get a lot of lower back injuries. But most often is that they'll look to side bend. And due to this side bending action, the QL ends up being quite overused. Another reason could be because the obliques aren't strong enough. Obliques are really important for controlling the side bending action of the spine, or also important for rotation. But if this isn't being trained and rotational function isn't optimal, the QL will look to take over this. Two main things that you need to do. You need to improve your thoracic rotation. This can be done with exercises such as eagles, windmills, quadruped rotations, seated rotations. These are all mobility exercises. But in order to get stronger, you need to look to, in rotation, look to strengthen the obliques. The key one would be side plank, rotational plank, single arm farmer walks, and also doing our pull off press variations too. And you should see that you're strengthening the obliques, you're improving that thoracic rotation, which will take a lot of strain away from the QL. So hopefully you start feeling a lot less pain in that area. So next question is best strength and conditioning for a teenager. So it depends what age teenager you're talking about. Are you talking about 18 or 19 year old, or are you talking about a 13 or 14 year old? So I'll take you through like what I'd see as a progressive journey in strength and conditioning for youth athletes. When they're younger, let's say 10, 11, 12 years old, we're looking at the fundamental movements, making training fun, working on coordination, speed, balance, and building up them foundational movement skills. And this is really important because you're a real formative age and you should be like looking to try and explore movement, not particularly looking to be really controlled in terms of the strength and conditioning, looking to get stronger or more powerful. It's all about kind of motor learning. So in this phase, you want to be working on like kind of them foundational movement patterns, but also adding a little bit of coordination, some balance. These skills will set you up for life. Now, in the next phase would be between 13 and 14 years old, where you are starting to do some strength training, a little bit more intensive, but these will be literally strength training exercises that are very, very foundational, looking at lighter weights and focusing on working on that movement. Not necessarily needing to get stronger at this rate. It's just about grooving that movement to then take advantage of that when they get into about 15 and 16 years old. When they're 13 or 14, you can be doing stuff like goblet squats, back squats. You can be learning how to do Olympic lifting. Just keep this quite light. I wouldn't go anything above their body weight. And with this as well, the young athletes will be going through a bit of a growth spurt. So it's important to keep working these movement patterns, because if they're getting taller, obviously that movement will be impaired. So they need to regroove that movement for when they get to 15 and 16 years old. Now, 15, 16 years old, depending on rate of maturation, seems to be where you can start getting your athletes, your young athletes, stronger. This is a window of opportunity where you've got your peak height velocity, and this is known in the literature to be the window of trainability where an athlete can get a lot stronger. You'd be looking to do lifting just above the body weight now, as long as that movement is suffice, using back squats, deadlifts, doing pressing and pulling action. And then when they're getting up to 16, 17, 18 years old, that's when you can really start pushing on with the strength and conditioning. This is a very, very rough guide because it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. It all depends on the training availability, their maturation rates, and everything like that. So if you're wanting more information, you can access our youth training program. The link is in the description for that, either on our Train Like Champion membership, or you can purchase the Train Like Champion Youth Training Edition. It's got all information about how to start applying strength and conditioning from an early age, but also gives you the tools to deliver this in a gym setting. We've got a range of different posters where you've got pictures, demonstrations, reps and sets that can be easily performed in an amateur boxing gym, but also can be performed in a strength and conditioning gym too. So we've got a fantastic question from Lewis Weaver, and something that we get quite a lot of boxing science is how to approach strength training for regular competitions in amateur boxing. So the reason why we get this quite often is because we work with quite a lot of amateur boxing, get a lot of interest from amateur boxing. A lot of our programs that we put out there is very much for like 10, 12 week training camps where it's suited for professional fighters. In amateur boxing, you could have 5 weeks notice, 5 days notice, sometimes even just a day's notice, and then you could be on a local club show. So it's quite hard to periodize programs around amateur boxing. Now, a few years ago, I actually released a video on what we were doing with our amateur boxers in terms of like approaching competition and how to manage that training phases throughout a season. If you're wanting to watch this in more detail, check out the link in the description where you learn like kind of how I planned out training throughout a full season. But in a short-term answer, what I would do is highlight key areas of the boxing season where you are wanting to achieve peak performance. So this could be for a typical like England boxing season, you'd have your CYPs, which is a national competition, which is around about October, November, maybe even creeping into December. And then you've got your national competition, which is national elites, or I forgot what they call it now, national amateur championships, your ABAs, for those watching that are old school. So you've got your ABAs, which typically start at the end of March, April time. This might differ for the level that you're at, whether you're a youth athlete, whether you're a schoolboy, and also whether you're a novice athlete as well. So novices are different time points as well. Typically what I'm trying to get at is you want to be focusing on 1 to 3 peaks within a season. You're looking to try and periodize that because it's very, very difficult to work a periodized program when you might get a short notice bout. And also when you're constantly looking to taper and do a full taper, you're limiting the physical adaptations that you're getting from your training. And also if you're working a speed phase for too long, that might diminish your strength gains. So what I would say for a typical strength conditioning plan for the amateurs is that you'd work on block periodization, where you're working on max strength, speed, strength, and then taper off for your main competitions. And then also you'd want to keep speed within the program, such as like jumps, plyos, sprints. That speed emphasis isn't lost at any time and can be utilized if you have a short notice bout, whether that's a week's notice or something like that. You don't want to be like not doing any jumps or doing any speed work and then suddenly having to do a taper program and having to be fast and explosive. So maintaining speed in the program is really important, even if you're working on maximum strength. An easy way to do this is complex training, where you're using heavy lifts and combining that with explosive jumps or explosive throws or anything like that. Also, what you need to think about deloading. So if you have a max strength phase and you get called up for a bout, what we'll do is just deload that weight, deload it to around about 80% of what you were lifting before, so keeping the intensity quite high, but then dropping the volume. So if you're doing 5 repetitions and 4 sets, drop that down to 3 threes. Then you're not getting any fatigue, but you're still getting the kind of minimum effective dose from that workout. And also you'd look to do that lift, probably finishing about 4 days out from competition, and then you'd do a taper session. So you'd have a taper session where you're working on jumps, working on banded shadow box, working on punch specific actions, working on rotational power, and then going into your bout. This means that you're still working towards adaptations from that training block, and also that you can continue that after that bout. So it is a bit of a minefield. Both I'll give you some good examples there on how you'd manage your strength conditioning around irregular nature of amateur boxing. Like I said, check out that video, links in the description, where I'm talking a little bit more in depth on how we planned out an amateur boxing strength conditioning program for a full season. Do sledgehammering and sprints increase punching power? So we've covered about sprints before, how we can increase vector force development, increase activation of soleus, which can transfer into improving reactive strength index. So we use sprints to not only condition our athletes, but to make them more explosive, which then can transfer into being more explosive in the ring. For sledgehammering, this is something that we've covered in our recent Boxing Science Reacts video. If you haven't checked them out yet, go and check them out. We cover a wide range of boxing superstars, analysing their training methods, what they're doing well, what they could do a little bit better, but most importantly, how you can adapt their training methods and put it into your training program so you can essentially train like a superstar. A recent episode was with Noah Nui, where he was actually using sledgehammer. I wouldn't necessarily use the sledgehammer, risk versus reward, for first of all. I probably can get better adaptations using a medicine ball, so using rotational slams or med ball slams. That's going to be a lot safer than putting a sledgehammer around my head, slamming it against the tire. You know, your hands could slip. Now, these things people could do all the time, but imagine if it does actually slip out your hand or bounce too hard off the tire and it hits you back in the face. You know, you're not probably going to get that with a medicine ball, especially like one of our slam balls. Another one is how far it's actually going behind your head. Now, with the med ball work, so rotational slams and med ball slams actually cue athletes to not go behind the head, because the more that it goes behind the head, more likely, because they're not as mobile in thoracic extension, not as mobile in the shoulders, have that flaring of the rib cage, which could start getting your lower back compensating for that movement and lower core activation. So you're moving away from what the goal of the exercise is. If you're wanting to improve core power, core rotational power, you're wanting to optimize activation of the core muscles, your abdominals and your obliques. Soon as you go back behind your head, start flaring the ribcage, you start compensating using lower back, so you're moving away from the key adaptation of the exercise. It becomes more of an arm movement, because if you're going from behind your head and slamming down, it becomes more of an arm movement rather than working the core. Because it's a little bit heavy and the lever length is large, the action becomes quite slow. We're looking for fast, repetitive actions. On rotational slam, it's all about the whip. On the med ball slams, it's all about how fast you can chuck it up and then throw it down to overload that stretch shortening cycle. You're not really getting that with a sledgehammer. So based on the risk versus reward, based on the optimization of the activation of the muscle groups that we're wanting to target, but also looking at that increase of rate of force development, I've been more looking towards doing more med ball work, med ball slams, rotational med ball slams, rather than going on the sledgehammer. Good question. This is on our YouTube channel. His son is a youth athlete and is moving from 101 pounds to 106 pounds. He's 13 and walks around at 103 and seems to be growing. Enjoy the speed, strength and HIIT workouts for Boxing Science. Thank you very much. And interested in a max strength program that will benefit him whilst moving up to the next weight division. Thanks, Wilson. Keep up the phenomenal work. So thank you very much for your kind words and interest in the program. What I would say is that he's 13 at the moment, a little bit like what we were saying before about like youth training and strength conditioning for youth athletes, is to mainly work on developing fundamental skills, foundational movement, keeping speed in the program, doing stuff like plyometrics and everything like that. Let the body naturally grow. So your son will more than likely get to that 106 pound limit without doing too much maximal strength training. They're very likely to just keep growing. Now, this brings me on to a keen subject that we often discuss down here at Boxing Science, especially with our nutritionist Lee Rickards, is that in amateur boxing, especially for youth athletes, you know, the weight categories become quite a big problem. Constant dieting for boxers, they're looking to grow, might actually stunt some sort of growth by not fueling the body properly. Amateur boxing, we believe, especially when they're younger athletes, they should be looking at a more balanced diet, being in a calorie surplus, so increased energy intake to help promote physical adaptations, to help promote growth and maturation. This will give them a better physical and athletic development in the long term rather than trying to get short-term gains, maintaining the weight or trying to keep the weight down into a certain weight category. This doesn't necessarily mean that young amateur boxers should not diet. They should diet. They should keep the weight down to make sure that they're in the right weight category for them. But they shouldn't be restricting themselves too much to keep to a certain weight category and not letting their bodies develop. So what you're doing is great because you're not staying to that 101 pound limit. You're wanting to increase to 106, but you're 13-year-old, or soon be 14 and 15, and you want to make sure that that physical progression is optimized. So optimizing that with your strength and conditioning, working on foundational movement patterns, working on speed and explosiveness, but then fueling them. So fueling them with the right nutritional strategies. And if you're wanting more information, go and contact Lee Rickards, boxingscience_nutrition on Instagram. I'm sure that he'll be happy to help guide you with some more information. Question, very specific one. I box Monday to Thursday, but I'm thinking of lifting Friday and Saturday. Is that a good idea? Not to shoot down your question, but no, it's not a good idea. Condensing your training into like 2 days, your strength training into 2 days back to back, this will limit the adaptation, limit the recovery that you're getting from the first session going into that second session. What you need to do is give yourself at least 2 or 3 days between your strength training sessions. Never do strength training back to back with most of our athletes at Boxing Science. In some scenarios, we might do a lighter strength session paired with a heavier strength session on the following day, but we don't normally do our strength sessions in such a condensed nature. What I do is look at your schedule. Now, I don't know what your training availability is, but maybe doing a shorter strength training session towards the start of the week, fit in around your boxing, maybe do it after a boxing session, doing some squats, press-ups, pull-ups, doing some lunges and maybe some core exercises. You can condense this into about a 30-minute workout, just adding that onto the end of your boxing session, or maybe doing that in the morning or something like that. The main thing is to make sure that your strength sessions, you have enough recovery time between your strength sessions and your strength sessions are separated adequately. Like I say, I'd aim for at least 2 or 3 days between your strength training sessions. A question from Al Hajbani. Hey Wilson, how many amateur fights should you have before turning pro? I'm 22. I think that means that he's had 22 bouts. So you can't really put a number on this. It all depends on the type of experience that you've had, the sparring, how long you've been in the gym. Some people just pick it up straight away, pick up their experience in the gym and in sparring and need very little amateur experience. Some need a lot more. But then if you have an extensive amateur record, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to have a successful professional career. Quite hard to give you a very definitive black and white answer. You got some great success stories. One down at Boxing Science, an athlete that we work with, Fabio Wardley, had just 4 white collar bouts, no amateur boxing experience, and now he's progressed through the professional ranks, is now British heavyweight champion. That is a fantastic story, and that's why it stands out, because there's not many people that actually go on and do that. A lot of people need them amateur boxing bouts to create that experience, but it all depends on how much and how successful you've been and what kind of experiences that you have within them bouts. if you're getting towards like youth level, you'd be looking to at least hit international bouts at youth level. If you haven't, be looking to do some senior bouts where you're boxing adults, more experienced boxers as well, potentially going into the amateur championships there as well. But at least have gone and boxed at a senior level before like turning over professional. Like I said, there's no black and white answer. It's all about the people around you that can guide you in the right way to then make that decision for you. Well, you make the decision based off that guidance of if it's something to do. So yeah, there's no black and white answer for this. It all depends on the athlete's experience, their capabilities too. Okay guys, that's the end of this Boxing Science podcast episode. Thank you very much for watching or listening. If you're not subscribed yet, hit the subscribe button. And if you've got time to hit the like button or give us a rating, hopefully 5 stars out of 5, please do so, because this elevates the status of these podcasts. We'll do more episodes, more Q&A sessions. We're hopefully going to get some guests on the Boxing Science podcast soon. Thank you very much. Hopefully see you on the next episode.